We're just going to leap into it. So this is Kate Magruder. It is January 17th, 2019. I'm recording an oral history for The Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is John Scharfenberger.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in New Jersey in 1951.
How did you grow up and where did you grow up?
It's sort of an interesting point that when we followed my father, of course, to California. He got a great job in Southern California, but we didn't have a place to stay. So he rented an old ramshackle old ranch house on the Warner Ranch in Woodland Hills. It had 2,000 acres and two houses. So it was kind of the last big piece of rural land in that area. So it was a great place to grow up. And my brothers and sisters spent tons and tons and tons of time out doing things, building forts, building dams, the whole thing. And then we moved to another place where my parents bought a house, and that was also slightly rural. We had 20 acres, and all the properties around us were kind of big. So it was kind of like horsey suburbs with big canyons around and still lots of trees and lots of vegetation. And we spent, you know, a lot of our time kind of playing outside in, you know, all this stuff. We weren't in the house much. We were always, you know, devising new things to do outside in the brush, in the ground. We made new dams. We planted trees. We had a great time.
As you began to grow up and look forward to where you were going to go after high school, what were you thinking you wanted to do? What propelled you after high school?
Well, I always wanted to be a rancher, and this started early when I was in high school. I mean, that was my interest. My father was a sort of frustrated farmer. He never got the farm, and he was interested in actually getting a place to live when he retired, and so he took me along with him on several kind of ranch trips to go look at ranches for sale. I mean, they were kind of wild goose chases because he really didn't have any intention of doing it at the time. But for me, it was really wonderful to get to these different places and see, you know, the country and the countryside, and to see expanses of land that was not developed and the way people could and did live there.
Where did you go to college and what did you study?
I went to Berkeley, and that was a pretty interesting thing for me because I wanted to study at first economics. I studied a million things, but I finally settled down on really wanting to go back to what I wanted to do, which is to live on a large piece of land or have things to do with large pieces of land. And so my interest was actually trying to, in a way, undo all the things I saw going on in the developed part of Los Angeles, all the million tract homes and strip malls and whatnot that were being built while I was a kid. My interest was in rural land planning. And so I went to the Department of Landscape Design, which did a lot of planning work, and got an independent major there, which was to kind of learn everything about land so you could make proper decisions about hydrology and geology and geomorphology and biology and forestry and stuff. So that was my, I wrote my own major and it was accepted. So I have a degree basically in biogeography, but I wrote it myself. It's now, you know, you can take it if you want. They offer it.
Was your inclination different than your other five siblings? Were you the only one out of the six kids in your family who had this kind of impulse?
You know, we all grew up together doing these things, but everybody went into different directions, whether it was political history or medicine or all kinds of things. So I was the only one who had any interest in an agrarian lifestyle. So, yeah, I was the only one, though everybody had an interest in that stuff, having grown up where we did. So I think it's one thing we all shared together really at the base of our existence.
So how was it that you ended up in Mendocino County, and when was that?
My best friends from high school ended up at UC Santa Cruz, and they got involved with Alan Chadwick's biodynamics garden thing. So, and they were all kind of, you know, acolytes of him. And early on, I realized it was only an hour and a half down to Santa Cruz. So I spent all my weekends and holidays down in Santa Cruz with them and working in the garden under Chadwick and learning all kinds of things. So it was during that period of time we all hatched all these crazy plans to, you know, maybe start a commune one day. And my big idea was to grow marijuana, and we could make enough money to start a vineyard and maybe a winery someday. And so Bonnie Doon, which is the area we were living in, where they had settled down, was an area that was really well suited to certain kinds of grapes. It's since been planted by those. There's nothing there then. And in the same book that recommended Bonnie Doon, they also said Philo, California was another great place for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and a place that hadn't been really proven much. So I think it was my second year in college. On a rainy weekend, a friend of mine and I came up here and camped at Hendy Woods and went looking for a commune site.
So you were looking to grow things. Why? What were you exploring?
When I was still in high school, I sort of took some marijuana seeds out of a baggie that I had with pot in it and planted those seeds. And my little brothers and I grew them, and they became huge plants. It was so amazing to be able to, you know, just put something in the ground and have something so well valued by us, and so easy to get. And so what a wonder. And so we shared everything we grew with friends of ours. And so for 3 years, we grew our own marijuana. When I left for college, my brothers continued to do that until our little patch was stolen. But meanwhile, I knew that the ease of that and what we were doing could basically allow us to do other things. And meanwhile, I had also gotten really interested in the wine industry by working with a fellow named Dr. Lee, and he owned 40,000 acres of land in Mendocino County. And my senior year of college, he sort of took me on. He was my mentor in a sense. He was 85 at the time. He would have me drive him in his old Oldsmobile 88 up to look at various ranches. And he always had a woman with him who was, he was having an affair, and it was Louise Davies, the woman who was really famous. Well, that's why I never learned her name. I found out later. And so we would go to his ranches and look at things. And he arranged for me to get a job at Stony Hill Winery in between my junior and senior year. So I was a kind of cellar rat at that fairly well-known vineyard for that summer. And it really introduced me into the sort of wine culture, and parts of it I loved, and also parts of it I didn't love at the time. So it was a really great thing to do working there. So that's how I always had both things in my head, marijuana, wine, grape growing. And so the other thing about grapes, it's so aesthetic. I mean, it's not like growing corn in a field. You really get to have, you know, be on a hill, have views, have basically air moving around. It's a wonderful thing to do. So that was, in an aesthetic sense, something that really I had had from when I was younger and traveled through France and Italy and seen these vineyards. They're beautiful.
How did you get to Mendocino County to live?
So one of my friends from Santa Cruz and I over Easter break came up and to look for a piece of property and see what could happen. So because of the book I had read on growing grapes mentioned Anderson Valley, we went to Hendy Woods and camped there, and then called the local realtor and Tony Hush. And so he took us up to some property. It was for sale up on Greenwood Ridge. A couple of the properties looked really great, and there was like six of us. So we all figured we could all put in, you know, we probably could come up with about $12,000 down, which is all we needed. And we could make the payments. I think the whole price was $30,000 with growing marijuana over the next several years. So that was kind of the plan. We put an offer in on the land, and the realtor, who was, turned out to also be the landowner, which we didn't know, he took it off the market. I mean, he didn't want competition. Anyway, that land is actually where Greenwood Ridge is now, where the winery is. It's a great piece of property. But that really gave me an idea of the geography I really wanted to live in and work with, and the environment. It was so kind of easy on the eyes, but also the weather was really clement. You know, it was never too hot, never too cold. And a perfect thing. So, you know, went home, and then, you know, basically my friends, you know, we all kind of moved away from that plan. And I continued at Berkeley and got my degree, you know, basically in biogeography with a lot of agricultural stuff in it, thinking that one day when I graduated, I would be able to get a job either for a vineyard or you know, something to do with land.
And then you loved this geography, you were going to find something, your friends had kind of moved on, and so you were looking at something maybe on your own.
Right. Well, and so indeed this happened. When I then in my junior and senior year, when I was working with Dr. Lee, you know, I was getting really close. This was really telling me how much I loved it, and, you know, how much I wanted to have, you know, a future in. And because I had sort of taken a generalist degree, kind of biogeography, he actually hired me at a college to get a do a survey of the 40,000 acres of different ranches he owned, and kind of do a master plan of what he thought the environmentally sensitive and correct things would be to do to develop some agriculture on different ones. And so some of it was vineyards, some of it was cleaning up after old logging things. But I think the key point was to try and find appropriate vineyard sites on these various ranches that he could then continue to develop. The problem is about 3 months into the job, Dr. Lee had a stroke, and his children thought, well, no new projects for Grandpa. And so I was able to stay living in the house I was staying in, but I didn't have a job anymore. So I got a job at Souverain Winery, again, as a cellar rat. I worked 10-hour days cleaning out tanks and, you know, doing all the things you do, you know, the physical labor that's important in winemaking. And I worked there for about 3 months. And then right at the end of harvest, my father called me and he said, you know, John, I think I'm getting really interested in finding a piece of property. Could you go look again? And I had been looking all along, but everything was so expensive. Napa Valley was so overrun. I mean, we're talking 1972. It was overrun and not a place you could farm, I thought, because there's just too much else going on. And there's parts of Sonoma that were okay, but I hadn't really looked too much up in Mendocino County, but I was living near Cloverdale. So I was driving up to Ukiah once and I saw a sign on a post saying for sale. And I called the guy, and this is right after my father had told me this, so I was looking. And I called it, and his name was Page Myard. And he was one of the original Myards that kind of settled and took care of the timberland in between here and Yorkville. Wonderful old guy. And he showed me a couple properties. And toward the end of a couple of days of looking, he showed me a property that looked not, you know, like it was going to work out. We were driving towards Lakeport, and I said, you know, there's no wine area, you know, in the mountains near Lakeport. But he said, you wait. And then by, you know, chance of topography, there was this wonderful upland shelf of great soils about 1,000 feet above Ukiah in elevation with an amazing view with lots of places for water developing. And vineyards had been put in there in the 1880s, but it kind of went out of business in the Prohibition. So we knew it could be done. So I told him about it. I said, yeah, that sounds really good. And well, so Paige then said to me, well, they have to sell it in the next week because there's some pending divorce. And the guy who owned it wanted to get, you know, the deal done before, you know, he had to whatever split the who knows. And so I told my father that, and he said, he and my mom, you know, flew right up and looked at it. And my father said, yes, that's what I want. That's a ranch I would love to live on when I get older. And what a perfect place. And the price was under $200 an acre. It was like nothing. Well, it's a lot then. But and so he bought the property and he said, John, do you want to caretake it for a few years until we figure out what we're going to do? Kind of come up with a plan and I'll hire you to help me. And so I did. And there I went. And I had the next, 5 years of my life learning the hard way how to fix tractors and grow grapes and all the great stuff that goes with, you know, fixing things and making things work. Up to that point, I'd never changed the oil in my truck. So I was really far behind having to learn a lot. So it was a really great learning experience to learn how to take tractors apart and put them back together. The ranch was about a half an hour away from Ukiah, so it wasn't very convenient if you ran out of things. So I made a plan to plant the vineyards over time. We were going to plant, you know, little by little, and over 10 years we would finish planting it. So the first group was done, and I was, you know, looking at all the interesting things, like how do you do everything. I had a consultant working with me. And then I just read a little article about something called drip irrigation. You know, I said, Alex, could we put drip irrigation in there? And he said, you know, I don't think they've done it yet in California, but maybe down here in Napa. So he asked, he said, yeah, there's somebody doing it in Napa. So I figured out how to find the parts for it, a guy over in Arbuckle, California, and I bought what I needed, which is this really jerry-rigged kind of weird irrigation system. But I put in the first drip irrigation on grapes, you know, and certainly in Mendocino County, And it worked really well. So it was really fun.
Before that, it was overhead sprinkling?
You know, before that, it had been overhead sprinkling, but believe it or not, a lot of the people in the Ukiah Valley were flooding. You know, they were just taking stuff out of out of the ground and just running down the furrows. And then, you know, sprinklers became pretty normal. And the good thing about sprinklers is you could also do frost protection. But the bioclimate we had up at Eagle Point Ranch was, it was basically frost-free. So I figured, well, I could do that. I can do this with just drip irrigation, and let's see what happens. And it worked.
Did you get raised eyebrows? Did people give you a hard time about that, or did people catch on pretty quickly?
No, it's hard to say. You know, I was kind of a newcomer, and I was from Berkeley, and I had long hair and a beard. And, you know, basically the irrigation places and the tractor places and the welding shops hadn't seen anybody like me come in and make orders and actually, you know, interact with them on complicated things. So their eyebrows were raised from the time they saw me. And so it was pretty funny to be the first, like, kind of hippie, you know, back to the land, but real farmer. They just didn't, you know, the locals had never seen anything the likes of it. They thought the hippies were the people who lived up in the mountains, and, you know, all the farm boys down here looked like us. You know, but I was the first one that sort of, you know, looked somewhat in the middle. I was definitely, my brain was at Greenfield Ranch, and my profession was working the land at Eagle Point.
As you looked around the community at that time, how did you see Ukiah?
In 1973-74 is when I started, and there was a lot going on in Ukiah. There was lots of little theater things, and I forget where there was a little store that everybody went to that bought things, and I remember, you know, kind of doing some music things. Along the road up to my house lived David Raitt and Mark Hansen, so I got to be good friends with them, and then they introduced me into kind of what they were doing, and they were kind of new up there as well, into what was going on in Ukiah, and it wasn't too long before I got to know, you know, tons of people. And that there's a whole kind of rather big community of people, you know, from all the ranches, Running Springs and the ones up in Potter Valley and even some down in Hopland. I mean, there was, you know, hundreds of us living in them there hills, and Ukiah was basically our place to go to get stuff and meet each other.
Can you think of a time, an experience that epitomizes for you what those early days were like, the energy that they held, or the promise that they held, or the sense of them at the time?
The thing that I loved about this group is they were so much fun. You know, everybody believed in fun. You know, we certainly took our share of drugs and drank a lot, but we did fun things. We used to all, every month we'd figure out which of the dive bars we would go to, and on Friday night all show up. I remember taking over the microphone at one of the places and actually call dancing for square dancing. It was like a really wild, wacky group. Also, there's a couple people interested in film things, and so they would bring films in and be shown. And there was a pretty vibrant group of people that was all growing through this period. There's some really great early political movements. One which is really based around land planning and trying to preserve agricultural land in Ukiah. And it, for me, that was exactly what I was totally interested in. So, you know, I got figured out who the people were doing things and sort of joined this, loose cadre of politically oriented people trying to make sure that, we passed a general plan, which was upcoming, that included all the things we wanted to save in Mendocino County. And that made things, you know, kind of safe for the future of farming. And so for me, it was everything I'd studied in school and everything I'd seen growing up that needed to be done. And here was a chance. So I got very active with that group, and that, you know, kind of saw me through, you know, the next several years of things, included, you know, meetings and speaking and going out and doing things. But it was a wonderful time.
Can you give me an example of something that ended up in the general plan, or something that you can see now is a legacy of all those meetings?
You can just drive through Sonoma County, northern Sonoma County, from north of Santa Rosa, and look at what's going on both sides of the freeway. It's pretty dense. But when I was in 1972, there wasn't much there. Well, you can drive into Ukiah Valley from Boonville Road, and it's no more dense now than it was then. Basically, they haven't overdeveloped. residential housing or commercial things here. And so basically the county was saved by this, and it saved us from becoming basically Sonoma County. Sonoma County had just done their master plan, but it was run by a whole lot of developers. And so they came up with a whole different subset of things to do. And ours was, I think, really well done and had, a pretty large contingent of people outside big ag and big commercial interests taking care of it.
Do I recall that you were in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar? Was that at Mill Creek Dams?
Well, there was a lot of wonderful people doing wonderful things, and a friend of mine, Jack Christ, was a neighbor of mine. He asked me if I wanted to be in a play that they were doing. I'd never acted in anything in my life, but it sounded like fun, and it was going to be done outside at the Mill Creek Dam, I think. And so I ended up having a singing part, which is really a joke because I'm not a very good singer. And I got to be in the play. And it was through that group of people, I just met a whole new cadre of friends, who had, very wonderful artistic interests and were up in Mendocino County trying to, have fun in theater and in music and things like that. It was really a pleasure, a really fun thing to do.
I remember you were on the board for the Northern Valleys Cultural Association, something called NIVCA, and it was a consortium of Michael Laybourne, who wanted to start the Mendocino Brewing Company, and Mary Knight, who wanted to start the Ballet Company, and the Ukiah Players Theater, and dance companies. Do you remember that? Do you remember your involvement in that, and what kind of propelled you into that?
I knew there was needs for a place for all these things to happen. It wasn't easy because there was no set theater that could be relied on. There were some nice things where things could get going, but there was a property up on in Calpella and on the highway, and it was an old vineyard a winery property with one of those really great old stone buildings that could really become an amazing theater. I sort of saw the opportunity and said, I'd love to work on this. What fun to get this thing and turn this into a little like magic spot, with both some agricultural things going on, some horticultural things going on, but all kinds of wonderful artistic things going on, all in the same place and in a really well-situated spot. It required, coming up with some money and starting a, 501c3, whatever that is. I didn't know at the time, but somebody else got to do that part. It was a real pleasure to kind of coalesce all of this energy and try and focus it on this one spot. I can't remember really how it sort of fell apart, other than the woman who was selling it, looked like she got some suckers on the hook and wouldn't cooperate with us. But anyway, it was really great fun to do, and it was really fun to see that as the beginning of so many wonderful things, like the Ukiah Players and their theater came out of that. And obviously the brewery found a great place, and it became, it was a real seminal project that a lot of people, cut their teeth in.
Was there a downside to that whole time? Was there something that was not so pretty?
It was hard living there then. I mean, I didn't have a big problem because I had a job, my own job, but I was gay, and there was not a lot of gay, there weren't a lot of gay people around. And if they were, I didn't know how to figure out how to find them. I tried, but failed. And that was for me, not a problem, but a challenge. And really, I could figure that out by just getting in my car and driving an hour and a half, and it's no big deal. But I think that the people who lived up there, really were there for reasons of the heart. It's so beautiful, and so nourishing to be in a community that was wonderful, and also in an environment where their horticultural interests and their just being involved in their own food was such a sustainably wonderful thing to be involved with. So I think it was never too tough. Let's put it that way.
Talk to me a little bit more about drip irrigation and your discovering it would work up here. And then what do you think that might have spawned in this county?
The good thing about drip irrigation is it uses water and it applies water right to the soil in a way that can be absorbed by the soil and taken down to the root zone. And so there's not a lot of evaporation. It's very efficient use of water. And in certain soils, depending on your soil type, you can really do everything you need to do with different kinds of drip. And I knew this was true. And I, you know, there's Israeli companies starting to use this on everything in Israel. Israel was the real first place. And I had read things about that happening. And it wasn't until I talked to some of my vineyard friends from Napa Valley where, you know, it was just starting to be used there. And so I that's who gave me the contact for the person in Arbuckle that I used to get the parts from. And they didn't really have all the pieces. We had to sort of cobble together things with micro tubing and staples. And I know it was really kind of silly, but it worked. And the other thing is, like every other piece of property up in Mendocino County, we're all limited by the water we have. And so I knew I had to put in a system that was very, you know, stingy with water, because we were up in the hills and we didn't have, you know, a lot of rain, you know, much storage. And the rains, you know, there's a lot of droughty time. So it turned out to be the perfect thing to do. And so now it's used in everything. You know, it was kind of odd to think back to my first marijuana. We used to drip irrigate that. What we did is we put a hose out to it and then capped the hose and put little holes in the hose itself, and then attached the hose to my, you know, the landscaping stuff at my mom and dad's house. And it went out there and just dripped. And then when it was done, we'd unattach it so we didn't get caught. And nobody was the wiser. So it was great.
Can you tell me more about the general plan and the people? When you were at meetings for the hashing out the general plan, were there people who were not agreeing with you, who didn't want to see open space, who were more interested in development?
I think the good thing about those days was the people who were interested in a proper general plan seemed to be the more articulate group of people. There were people who were, you know, not necessarily insiders. They were people from far away who had seen the reasons for these things being needed. And also some of the local families really also saw it as a way to protect their livelihoods in agriculture, especially cattle people. It was great to if you have a cattle ranch, you don't want a big housing development in the middle of it because of, you know, dog problems and all kinds of other things. So it was kind of, you know, a good thing. It wasn't overwhelming, but it was very much smart. And so it really seemed like the smart thing to do. And we got a lot of people who were sort of on the fence, who were kind of very well-heeled local land people they would probably have voted for Trump this time. They were completely behind a good general plan, and they knew that by having a good general plan, their land would be worth way more in the future. And so it was sort of a combination of things that all made it work.
So when we drive into the Ukiah Valley coming north on 101, and we come over Burkhill Drive and we look down, the land that is open, that is in agriculture, not open, it's being used, it's in agriculture on the east side of 101, that is zoned agriculture in the general plan?
My understanding is, yes, it is, that agriculture on the east side of 101 was to be, that whole valley part anyway, was to be kept in agriculture and with, you know, appropriate zoning, acreage minimums and things like that. So, and then there was a little bit more flexibility on the other side. I think it remains today that there's lots of spaces in and around Ukiah, but also in and around the northern part of Ukiah for lots of housing to be built without really impacting agriculture very much.
So tell me about how you went from growing grapes to making wine.
I became part of a group of winemakers. I wasn't a winemaker, but they all were, who would get together and taste wine every couple weeks. And so it's all the major winemakers from, you know, the vineyard, the wineries in Mendocino County, and a couple of other people from outside. And I was sort of the, you know, the pedestrian was brought in. I was not a trained winemaker, but I knew a lot about grapes, and I knew about the potential of grapes, and I drank a lot of different wines from different parts of the world. So I was kind of the, you know, the ringer in this group. And it was interesting tasting with them. I remember my tastes were very parallel to the common understanding of flavors with almost everything, until we had a tasting about champagne, on French champagnes, and also on some California ones. And I loved the French champagnes. They were so smooth. They were so delightful. They were light. They were crisp. They were, you know, could just go on all night. And the California ones were a little clunky and kind of heavy, especially the ones from Napa Valley. And so when it came onto it, all the winemaker guys were like, loved the California one and California ones, and didn't like the French ones, which I thought was so bizarre. And I think maybe that's why there aren't a lot of, you know, it's a small industry. People are not making it, you know, in the right places. And so I forget how it came upon, but I was right around the same time I brought this up to Barney Fetzer. And he said to me, you know, John, we're sitting on a like heaven for champagne like wines, Anderson Valley. So I was like driving past the gravel pit on Talmadge Road one day, and I thought, oh my God, I should make champagne or sparkling wines from Anderson Valley grapes, because it's so cold over there. And back in the 70s, they were having a lot of trouble ripening their wines. A lot of Cabernets barely could make it. And the Pinot Noirs were thin and, you know, acidic. And the Chardonnays weren't so hot. I mean, so in a sense, those things would be exactly like the condition in France. In a cold area, you would want coldness. You would want red wines to barely make it, because you're trying to grow a grape that has a long time on the vine, but without a lot of heat. So it has much different characteristics. And so I think within about 4 months, I just said, well, I'm going to make champagne. Of course, I didn't know how, and I didn't know how I would get the money to do it. And I just said, you know, it was just like an idea. So I did a lot of research, and I think that's been what I've done about a lot of things. I've done a lot of research on different things that I wanted to do, and then done them. And you learn a lot about, you know, a whole panoply of things that you don't expect to. But anyway, I sort of did my research. I talked to a lot of people in Anderson Valley about the growing situation over here, and how a lot of them were having a hard time selling their grapes because it was so cold, and they weren't able to get good ripeness. So it's a long story. I'll try and make it a little shorter. I was able to, my personal savings, which is about $50,000 at the time, was all I had, but it was enough to really get started. I ordered tanks. We rented some space in near the health club in Ukiah. I got a contract with a vineyard in Anderson Valley to buy grapes at a good price. And my plan was to then have other people help me do it. So the first year we took the grapes over to Fetzer, and Fetzer did a really interesting pressing that tried to emulate the way they press grapes in Champagne. It was really fun to do that. And then they fermented those things to us until they were just getting going. Then we would take that wine, it was sort of unfinished, and then truck it over to our winery, which is back behind the health club. And there we had tanks, and we built our own catwalks, and we built our own a lot of stuff. I mean, so we didn't spend much money on it. So we put the wine there and finished the fermentation. And then the next spring, you know, sat down to really do the blending that's required to make a good champagne. So it was really fun, but we were kind of doing it by what we had read from, you know, PR things. And I actually went to France with Thal Dolan for a few weeks and had an amazing look at the way things are done there. And it kind of discouraged and encouraged me at the same time. But we tried to emulate the things that made sense to flavor. And that was the important thing, is the items that make sense to flavor were the things we had to control. And so the grapes you use, the type of press you use, how ripe they are at the time. So you take some grapes and you press it hard once and then harder the second time, and you'd separate those two. And so at the end of the day, you had a whole paint box of different flavors to put together into what you wanted. And that's the typical way of making champagne. It's not the typical way of making Cabernet or Pinot Noir or Chardonnay, which are all like one thing. And that thing is sacred. It's a blend. So we proceeded with this, and that was in 1981. And in 1983, we had our first bottles. And you know, it was great. We took it out to the market. So we were the first manufacturers of sparkling wine from Anderson Valley. It's kind of nice. We beat Roeder by a couple of years, I think. Still, you know, they've done an amazing job too. But they knew what I did. I mean, when they came to Anderson Valley, I knew that they knew what I knew. I mean, we all knew the same stuff. It was great, and I knew I was right. So we continued to do that, and I stumbled along with the winery. I mean, it's a very difficult business to be in because it's a lot more like perfume and, you know, handbags, and it is like, you know, it's luxury goods. But at the same time, you know, people appreciate flavor, and so we tried to stay on with good flavor. And over the next 5 or 6 years, I just sort of stumbled into making better and better wine.
Okay, so continue with the champagne saga.
Anyway, so our wines continued to get better and better and better, but I was getting poorer and poorer and scarier. So one of the things I did learn to do was to work my butt off trying to sell things. And that really taught me how to market things, and also to try and really think of what the people that I'm selling to want, and learn how to articulate the things that make sense to them that are true. And so that was a great part of it. The other part is trying to find money from people who want to invest. And so I was able to get investors into the winery, stay afloat until really, luckily, in the late 70s, I think 78, a French company was looking for a project in California. They tried my wine. They really liked it. They said, "Can we come and see your winery tomorrow?" I gave them the address. They arrived in a helicopter. And they said, "You made that wine in this garage?" Anyway, it became, you know, they really wanted to do something. So they were wonderful people. They were the sort of caviar socialists of France. Wonderful group of people. Really had wonderful social interests in basically. We did a lot of planting trees. I think I planted 20 or 30,000 trees on the property we had here. And also livable income we paid. What we were paying, or actually is just now being replicated. We were paying like today's wages 20 years ago. And it was my idea. And we had health care and we had pensions and all that stuff. So it was really great to be able to work that way and feel so good about the fact that we were doing that right. At the same time, the wine tasted great. And with their help, we built the winery in Philo, planted more vineyards, and by 1995, you know, basically we're hitting our stride. We're making a little bit of money. We're getting great accolades everywhere, and it was great. But at the same time, I didn't really like my boss, and she was kind of a difficult person to work with. Luckily, they had gone through some financing and needed to buy out all the little investors in all their little projects, which was like, you know, Christian Dior and Kenzo and a whole bunch of more fashion brands. But they asked me what I wanted for my remaining shares of stock. And I thought, well, I don't know. And so I came up with a number that seemed a lot to me. And they said, sure. And so I was basically allowed, like, free. I have no debt. I have, like, money. I have a good job. And so I continued to work for another year, but then realized working with this situation wasn't fun for me. The problem with a lot of people's interests in winery or impressions of it is there's so much marketing, there's so much palaver, there's so many, you know, so many people you have to meet and remember their names and stuff. So luckily, I got myself out of that, had enough money to buy a little piece of property and build a house in Philo, and thinking I could retire. But then I realized, God, you need really a lot of money to retire. I didn't have enough. But meanwhile, a good friend of mine who was in Mendocino County for a while, Robert Steinberg, I met up with him, and he had had a sort of a bad diagnosis health-wise, and he said he was going to die of cancer, you know, sometime in the next little while. And his interests were learning how to cook, learning how to play the piano, and learning how to paint. Well, the cooking went well, but the rest was, well, who knows. But he had tons of friends in the food business, and he and another guy came up with an idea of making chocolate using excess capacity in some of the little coffee roasters. So they fiddled around with it for a few months, and then I ran into Robert on the street, actually, and he said, you know, we're having a hard time getting going with this. Can you come and take a look at it, help us with our business plan and stuff like that? So I met with them, and they didn't really have a business plan. They just wanted to do something, and they needed to know how to start.
So you mean the excess capacity in coffee roasters? They could use coffee roasters to roast the cacao beans?
That's what they thought. Unfortunately, they didn't do the research to find out that they couldn't, because it's a different kind of roaster, and the ability to clean out the cacao, it wouldn't work anyway. But meanwhile, they had got them started. So Robert actually went to France and worked at a chocolate company for a couple weeks. And anyway, they had the thing started. But when I heard of the idea of chocolate, I said, you know, I eat chocolate every day. And I, you know, when I come back from France, I buy chocolate from different, you know, manufacturers. I know the brands and I know the different ones. And it's not done in the United States. So I said, you know, Robert, I'd love to help you. And then within a day or two of starting to look at how we would go about it, and I said, we need to get a place. And they were like, oh, you're kidding. I said, no, we need machinery. Like, oh, you're kidding. It was really fun. And so I basically did what I knew how to do, which is, you know, set up a little company, find a space, get the machinery, you know, ordered and put in place, which is basically old stuff that we were buying out of junkyards and having refurbished. Robert had some great resources in the cacao world in Venezuela from, I guess, his housekeeper's sister or something like that. And so we were starting to bring in really, you know, lots of coffee beans, cocoa beans, or cacao. And we started tasting them in his apartment. I said, look, the only way, this is not going to be a mess because there's so many ambient flavors. We have to remove ourselves from this building. We need to roast everything exactly the same. We need to keep it in like a white thing. We need to grind it up exactly the same way. And just do exactly what I learned to do in the wine business, is treat this like a real protocol of how you go about this. And then when we started tasting, you know, it's pretty hard to, when you taste, everything's kind of all over the board. You know, it's like bitter and blah, 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 and sweet and fruity, all kinds of things. So I said to then Robert, I said, look, we've got to use the format that I had learned in the wine world of what's the physiology of the taste experience? What forms that? And over time, basically, you know, you take a bite of chocolate and it's cold and then it starts to melt and then it's slightly sour and then it's a little bit tart and sour. And then the sugar starts to kick in, and then so that becomes fruitiness. And then that fruitiness starts to really build until some of the tannins start showing up. And then the fat causes this late middle palate, and then suddenly the remaining tannins just rinse your palate and you're ready for another bite. But this is something that happens over time, and there's different chemicals and different characteristics that are affected by physical things all along the way. So when you're figuring out what you're blending with, you have to understand the conditions of the beans, what are they like, what are they good for, and then when you're tasting it, try and put together basically the script for this flavor. And it might, you know, it's like a 5-second script, but you can kind of follow it and it works really well. So that's what I knew, and that's what, you know, I taught him how to do it, and that's what we did. So over the years, you know, I mean, we used that, and luckily we stumbled into a lot of the right stuff, and we were pretty well kind of situated in San Francisco. Robert knew tons of chefs. I knew a lot of wine and food writers from the champagne business, the wine business, and so we were able to, you know, I could walk up to, you know, Julia Child and give her a bite, and she'd say, "Darling, that's really good. It tastes like the chocolate I grew up with." And she actually ate a lot of Scharfenberger till her last days. She was still getting a pound a week sent to her by a friend. Anyway, so Robert and I, you know, we were both perfect for the situation. So we sort of divided up our duties, and I did a little bit more of the marketing and product development and some of the business stuff. He certainly helped with the product development a lot. And also he had really fine, refined taste and things. So, you know, he knew his colors, he knew his fonts, all that stuff. So I could come up with the idea and then he would correct it, which is great. So he was kind of a reactive and I was proactive. And my ideas weren't always so great, so he'd fix them. But he couldn't come up with them on his own. So it was perfect. We got along really well that way. And everything worked well. And, you know, the company grew like crazy. And within, you know, by 1993, when Google was just getting started, but if you Googled chocolate, 5 of the top 10 hits were Scharfenberger in the world. That's pretty good. And so we realized that what we had done is share these ideas with everybody. And because we shared our understandings of flavor and a manufacture of chocolate, and also its context and history, its historical context, but also its environmental context, which is really interesting as well, that people liked to write about us. And because we had the answers, you know, we were written about, whereas most of the other companies, everything's like a secret. No, there's no secrets. You just tell everybody your secrets and they love you. So anyway, so we were growing really well. We were starting to make a little bit of money. And again, we had to find investors for that as well. And then these guys came to the food show in San Francisco in 1995. They just came by and said hello. And they were, you know, kind of these guys wearing suits. Which is kind of unusual at that food show, but then they were all from Pennsylvania. They had their tags turned into their chest so we couldn't figure out how they were, and it was a group of people from Hershey. So they said, can you spend some time with us maybe, you know, tomorrow? And so we made a date, and we went and sat with them somewhere out of the show for about 20 minutes, and they just, you know, they said, you know what, you guys are doing an amazing job. You know, they told us the Google thing. It's like, you know, we're not even in the top 30. Hershey wasn't. So they said, would you be interested in kind of selling your company? And I said, no, I've got the best job in the world. I'd spent the Friday before actually in a whole bunch of chocolate ice cream trials with Haagen-Dazs. It was like really fun. And I was working with Michael Ricciuti on different kinds of caramel and chocolate. And there was lots to do still. So anyway, we stayed friends, and they came back and actually doubled the price they had mentioned the first time a few weeks later. And we started thinking about it, and Robert's health was getting worse. So that was a lot of it. He was not able to spend as much time, and it wasn't quality time always with us. So I knew he had some interests, and I started thinking, you know, I love what I'm doing, but I'm going to have to find a replacement for myself anyway. So within about 3 or 4 months, I asked them. I said no, and they doubled the price again. So it was pretty hard to say no. So we sold the company, and the worst thing to do, and the people were wonderful. Hershey, you know, is run by a foundation for underprivileged kids. They're really wonderful people, nice, sweet, and they're really good at marketing to the like lower tercile of American demographics, which we aren't. So they had a really hard time doing it, but I wasn't going to be able to, you know, move this, basically this big ship in another direction. So they basically, you know, said, John, thanks a lot. We'll continue. We'll take it from here. Robert helped them a bit on some blending. And then they actually rehired me to go all around the world to all of the farms that we bought from. So I went to 120 farms in 22 countries around the world. It was so much fun to meet all the different growers that grew for us. And it was such an amazing group of people. Really, really wonderful. And it taught me a lot about the problems with the farming. The farming does not have to be poor. You just have to be smart. The Vietnamese can make, you know, from the same hectare, they can make $8,000 an acre, a hectare. And in South America, they can only make like $400. It's like, what? It's with the same stuff. They just don't know how to do it. They weren't taught. And because these things are things that, you know, weren't indigenous to these communities. Whereas the Vietnamese said, well, nothing's indigenous here. We have to learn about it. So they studied it. And so they did really wonderful things to be able to, you know, have good crops, but also quality crops. So Vietnam is like up and coming for chocolate. I think they're going to really kick it. It's really good.
I'm going to ask you that question. As you look at your life, because you came here to Mendocino County and planted yourself here and have operated from this place. You've traveled a lot, but from this place. How has that shaped you, do you think?
I think the whole period of my formative years here in Mendocino County, which are still going on, you know, there was an ethos here that was shared, I think, by the people who moved here. And a lot of that ethos was our the reasons we kind of headed this way. And we've just kept them with us. I mean, in terms of how you do business with other people, how you deal with government issues, how you do everything. And so it's that ethos that was, you know, it was taken with me. And I luckily had it reaffirmed, you know, with my partners in the champagne business. But then, you know, Robert and I had those same ethoses when we went to work. So we paid everybody fairly, and, you know, we had a fairly non-hierarchical system of working. And so those things we took with us. And they're things that really we didn't do them for marketing reasons. We never told people that we were paying double fair trade. But we just did it because it was the right thing to do. And that's the way I think that a lot of businesses are thinking now. You have to have sustainability as some thing. Sustainability should be a minimum. You should only be sustainable. And if you can't be sustainable in all those things, you shouldn't do anything. I mean, just stay home. So if anybody says they're that, I don't believe it. And so I think that's really what I've taken with me. And I work for tons of little companies now, and it's really fun to see how smaller and younger companies are embracing all of these different things. And I think it's nice to see how proper manufacturing thoughts are kind of going into everything, whether it be fish farming or tofu making or sauerkraut production, all the things I'm involved with. These things are like heart and part and parcel of all these people's things. And it was without me, we've all stayed with it. So this is the new growth of food. It's coming through from two sides. I mean, there's a big side at of large things where people are using these ideas as marketing, but then there's a larger thing of people just producing things well, and it's part and parcel of what they do. And so that's what I'm really gratified by, is I'm just part of a group of people that are doing things well and producing products that needed to be improved. So we're making things that taste better and are better for you and are still, affordable. And that's that. It's a real wonderful thing to be part of that movement.
So how do you think that movement, the fact that so many people came here and so many people stayed here, how has that shaped the county?
Well, when I look around at the people that are here, especially in Anderson Valley, it's probably more my focus than other places. Basically everybody here who does anything is from that group of people. Even in the store, the grocery stores, and there's a couple of remainder families here, but a lot of those people have become really hip too. It's really interesting to see some of the old logging families just being so proactive in whatever their new ventures are. A lot of them aren't still growing, taking care of trees. But I think that it has affected this area. We're the majority now. People with those ethos kind of run the place in this valley. In Ukiah, it's a little less evident, but I think at the same time, it's still there. There's still a lot of there's a lot of change that needs to be done, but I think that the proportion of people that have ethos that are very positive, are here, and over the years we're just going to continue to make a bigger and bigger part of it. If you look at who voted for Ralph Nader, I think two times ago, there's two precincts in the country that were completely stood out. One was in Berkeley and the other was in Philo. It was pretty amazing just to see that. And it made me proud to know that I'm in an area that thinks about things, questioning and challenging and willing to put their ideas into practice.
So thinking about putting ideas into practice, do you have a sense of what could still happen? There's lots of people still here like you who have hopefully still years to be here and to be putting things into practice. What might be waiting for us to do? If we were coming now, as young people would have had the opportunity to do something like seeing this landscape and what needs to be done, what could we do? What might that be?
I think you really have to look at the, what's here, what's simple about here. There's a housing crisis in this area. There is not proper housing. And so that's my new project, is to develop worker housing that's affordable and safe and clean. And looking at the business part of it, is you make just as much money making houses for, farm workers as you do for rich people. And it's a lot easier to do. So I think there's a lot of challenges getting the government to kind of be a little bit more proactive in this line, but it doesn't. It's still, the numbers are there and the numbers work. So if I was a kid coming here, I'd get to work building houses for people, and I'd get to work growing things, because I know kids who, with basically a spade and a van are making $50,000 an acre growing food for restaurants. You know, just it's not hard. You just have to do it. And I think a lot of people aren't simple enough about it. They're always looking, it has to be this thing, and it has to be part of this program. The program has to be part of that program, and da da da. And really, frankly, just building and growing and making for people is really, I think, the quickest way to improve things, and probably is the right thing to do.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, I love living here. And I've lived here for, you know, since 1973, and I'm going to live here for a lot longer. And it's wonderful to look out my window and see trees that I've been looking at for the last 20 years. And in those 20 years, they've grown 30 feet high, higher than they were. And they were big trees then. So you see these trees here used to be, I can measure them against my house, and now they're, the bigger ones have gotten huger. It's really a pleasure to be part of that, you know, kind of witness to landscape growth. It's really, really, that's my biggest pleasure.